Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's podcast is entitled Parents' Perspectives on AFM. My name is Gigi DeFebri, and I will be moderating this podcast along with Rebecca Whitney. The TMA is a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website as well as on iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, you can send us a message through the chat option available with GoToWebinar.
Good morning, everyone. This is Rebecca Whitney. Just to give you a bit of background on the podcast, this particular series of sharing patient and family's perspectives started back in 2016. And we believe it's important to continue to share the message and the experiences of the families and individuals experiencing a rare neuroimmune disorder. Today, we're actually focusing on acute flaccid myelitis, or AFM. We're joined on our podcast today by Jeremy Wilcox and Rachel Scott, both parents of children diagnosed with AFM in 2018 and 2016, respectively. Our goal today is to hear from both of these parents about their journeys from onset and diagnosis to where they are today as advocates for research, change, and hope. Jeremy Wilcox is I was just going to introduce Jeremy. He's a husband to his wife, Jess, and father to their eight children. He's a graduate of Geneva College with a bachelor's degree in business. His four-year-old son, Joey, was paralyzed from the neck down and diagnosed with acute flaccid myelitis in September 2018. Joey spent 36 days in the hospital, first in the ICU and then inpatient rehab at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore, Maryland. He's continued outpatient therapies for 6 months. Through intensive daily therapy, Joey has regained the ability to walk, run, jump, and has full use of his arms and legs. Jeremy began his AFM advocacy efforts in October 2018, first with Virginia Department of Health, with the agency admitting suspected and confirmed cases of AFM existed in the Commonwealth. Jeremy helped bring together AFM families in leadership at CDC and NIH, elected representatives in Congress, and presented to the CDC AFM Task Force in Atlanta. Jeremy was a guest on Matter of Fact with Soledad O'Brien, has interviewed with NBC, ABC, and CNN, and is a parent representative for the AF Working Group, headed by Dr. Carlos Pardo, which brings together dozens of stakeholders collaborating to improve AFM patient outcomes. Jeremy has been advocating for federal funding for AFM research, transparency, and state reporting, including making AFM a national notifiable condition, and most importantly, raising overall awareness for this uncommon, devastating illness. Gigi, would you like to introduce Rachel?
Sure. So Rachel Scott is a mom of five kids, ages 10 years to 10 months. She graduated from Kansas State University with a bachelor's in secondary education and from Harvard University with a master's in math education. She taught middle school math until the birth of her second child, Braden. Braden was a happy, healthy kid until he was diagnosed with acute flaccid myelitis a few months after he turned five. Braden spent almost 8 months in hospitals and rehab before he was able to rejoin his family at home. Braden has made tremendous progress from having movement in just one hand to being able to walk short distances and use his left arm. He still requires full-time nursing to care for his breathing and feeding needs. Over the past 3 years, Rachel has become therapist, nurse, cheerleader, and advocate. Rachel is on the board of the Acute Flaccid Myelitis Association, a nonprofit that aims to support and advocate for families affected by AFM. Her desire to advocate for better education, methods of diagnosis, and treatment of AFM has brought her to Washington, D.C. to meet with legislators and to Atlanta to meet with the CDC's task force on AFM. She's also a member of the parent subgroup of the AFM working group with Jeremy. Braden's story has been featured on many major news outlets, the front page of the Houston Chronicle, and as the subject of an NBC mini documentary. Even though she has found herself in a role she never could have imagined, she's still able to find goodness in her day and loves watching all of her children grow and achieve new things. So welcome and thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much.
So to start, I'm going to begin with Rachel. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, your family, and your child? You know, how old was he when he was diagnosed?
Yeah, so Braden was five when he was diagnosed. At that point, we had four kids. We have five now. And you know, similar, everybody's story, whenever we hear all these parents talking about their stories, are so similar, where you have a healthy kid, a normal family, and then all of a sudden your life takes a sharp turn and goes in a different direction. So Braden's story started on the 4th of July in 2016. He was just not acting like himself, and over the course of a few days, really just kept getting weaker. His first symptom was that he couldn't swallow. He threw up when he tried to like eat our snacks on the 4th of July and couldn't swallow anything. Gradually kept getting weaker, eventually was admitted to the hospital. And on July 9th, so 5 days after he started kind of going downhill, he was lost the ability to breathe. His diaphragm was paralyzed, and he was life flighted to a bigger hospital in Houston. And that kind of was when things started getting serious. So from there, he spent the next almost 8 months in hospitals and rehab, working to get stronger. And we've learned a lot since then. We're now really knowledgeable about a lot of really, really specific stuff. But we're grateful for his progress, and are really committed to making sure that we raise awareness and prevent this from happening to other kids.
Thank you, Rachel. Jeremy, how about you? Can you tell us a bit more about Joey, about your family, and how he was initially diagnosed?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, about the so we have eight children. Joey's our sixth born, and shortly after his fourth birthday, everybody came down with a cold, and you know, we ended up staying home from church that weekend. But by the following weekend, everybody seemed to be over that. So it was uneventful. Nobody had to go to a doctor or anything. But the morning of September 24th, which was a Monday, Joey woke up with a fever. He still had an appetite. He was running around. You know, we didn't really think too much about it. But the following day, he woke up with left side facial paralysis. And, you know, this was very concerning to us, and having, you know, looked at Google and talking to folks, we weren't extremely concerned, but we were definitely keeping a close eye on it. The following day, we ended up taking him to the hospital, to the emergency room. They ran, I think, just a quick swab to see if he had strep, and then they ended up sending him home. And so the fever persisted, and he ended up continuing to lose the ability to move his limbs. And by Friday morning, we decided we were going to take him back. We ended up going to a different hospital, to the Children's Hospital, and he was unable to walk by this point. And we, you know, they did a spinal tap, CAT scan, they ran blood tests, everything came back negative, and they admitted him to the ICU. And it wasn't until the next morning when they did the MRI that they discovered he had inflammation from his brainstem all the way down his spine, isolated to the gray matter. He ended up never losing the ability to breathe on his own. But it began the journey of, you know, spending 36 days both in the hospital and in rehab. So it was a long journey for us, but that's how everything began.
Right. Thank you. You know, I'm sure this was a very, you know, scary time when all of this was happening at the beginning. So Rachel, going back, can you just tell a little bit more about kind of the onset of AFM for Braden and what symptoms he was experiencing and kind of how it progressed? And did you notice that something wasn't right really quickly, or how, you know, how did you kind of come to the realization that something was wrong?
Sure. Yeah. So it started with not swallowing. And you know, that I feel like that was something that was kind of not insane. You know, like Jeremy was talking about, when you wake up and half of your face is paralyzed, that's alarming. But not swallowing, you can blame that on a sore throat, you know. So we kind of assumed his throat didn't feel good. We kept trying to get him to take Tylenol and drink some water, and he couldn't. But within a few days of just getting weaker, still not swallowing, we were like, well, at a minimum, you're dehydrated and we need to get you some fluids. So, you know, when we took him to our little urgent care, they gave him fluids, said he probably had strep and mono, which we thought was a really horrible diagnosis. And we were like, oh my gosh, how are we going to deal with strep and mono? That sounds terrible. In retrospect, that would be infinitely better than what we ended up with. But at that point, they gave him steroids and antibiotics and said he should probably feel better pretty soon. So we went home. That evening, he was worse. So we went back and they went ahead and admitted us. But, you know, I think because Braden's presentation was a little bit different, he didn't suddenly lose an arm or a leg, which a lot of kids do. We blamed it on other stuff, and people probably didn't react appropriately in the beginning to, you know, look for something neurologic. But once his breathing stopped, once he was unable to breathe, that's when things kind of got more heightened and more serious, and they started, you know, doing other tests and looking at it differently. Because at, you know, a week, when it's gone by with a week of him not eating, you expect a child to be weak because they haven't been nourished. They don't have, you know, all the nutrients that they need to function. So it took a while for us to get to a point where people were taking it seriously. And when they, you know, initially they diagnosed him with Guillain-Barré or anterior horn cell disease or a couple of things that are similar and may have had better recoveries than we've had, but it kept, you know, every time they mentioned something, it was a little bit worse. So we kept just getting a little bit worse news. And when we finally got to the diagnosis of AFM, it was something we've never heard of. I think hardly any families have been diagnosed with AFM and had prior knowledge about it because it's still so rare. So we, you know, we're trying to Google and find out information. My sister's actually a surgeon, so she reached out into her, you know, network of physicians to try to get some more information. And it was just really, I mean, such an insane place to be when you have a perfect, healthy kid one minute. And, you know, within a short period of time, they are on a ventilator, unable to breathe on their own, unable to eat. And the doctors aren't able to tell you what might help. There's no treatments that are definitively helpful in stopping the progression. We have lots of anecdotal evidence about parents who think things help. Braden had IVIG and he had plasmapheresis, and we think that helped, but we're not really sure. So they couldn't tell us what kind of recovery he'd have. They couldn't give us any sort of indication of what his life would look like. And we know that there were kids who, you know, didn't ever really make much progress, and there are kids who've made lots of progress, and it was really hard to tell in that moment which end of the spectrum Braden would land on. So we're, you know, trying to process a whole different future for our kid than we had imagined for him, and trying to figure out how to deal with all of our other children, how to live in two different cities for 8 months. And I mean, it was just something that you could never imagine going through on your own. And we're grateful for the community of parents that we found on Facebook who really were our best source of information. There's a great group that is able to support each other and offer up information, and we really just gives each other hope about what kind of recoveries these kids may have.
Thank you so much, Rachel. I know it's such a probably surreal experience, and I know from personal experience with my own son how difficult it is, and looking back, just it doesn't always seem real. But thank you so much for sharing that. And Jeremy, in hearing, you know, Rachel's story, there is definitely some comparison and some contrasting as far as symptoms and how Joey was diagnosed. I know you mentioned earlier that it wasn't until like the following day where they were able to confirm AFM. Can you give us a little bit more about that, kind of how that diagnosis went? Did they also treat Joey with antibiotics until they could determine what exactly it was? Did they give you any kind of suspected diagnosis or test for any infections until they were able to confirm the acute flaccid myelitis?
Sure, yeah. And let me just add one comment that Rachel made just following on that. you know, when he couldn't move half of his face, you know, that is very alarming. But it's interesting because, you know, we're thinking, well, maybe it's Bell's palsy. I mean, I've never seen it in someone that young. But, you know, when we took him to the ER the next day, the hospital really didn't seem very concerned. So it was basically like, oh, it must be just a virus that, and he'll get better on his own. So there was just a lack of awareness. But Joey was never officially diagnosed with AFM. And I don't know if that's, when I say officially diagnosed, I mean, in the computer systems of the hospitals, they don't have, a lot of these hospitals, the software doesn't even have acute flaccid myelitis as an official diagnosis. So he was diagnosed officially with, first it was myelitis, which is a very general term for inflammation of the spine. But then when he was discharged to Kennedy Krieger Institute after 14 days, his official diagnosis was multifocal encephalomyelitis, which seems to be, in my opinion, kind of a piecemeal of you know, it's affecting multiple limbs. It's inflammation of his brain all the way down his spine. But never did they say, oh, it's absolutely AFM. But they were able to pinpoint that they had seen, or they were able to determine after seeing the MRI, and a lot of doctors met outside of the ICU, outside of our room. So yes, they did treat him just the same way that doctors knew how to treat this, or at least to try to throw things at it during the acute phase. So initially, he was on broad spectrum antibiotics, antivirals, as they ran all these different tests to see if, you know, was it Lyme, was it this, that, and everything was coming back negative. It wasn't until the evening of the third, we came in on a Friday, and by Saturday night they decided, okay, we're gonna treat him with IVIG, and so he ended up going for 5 days with, no, sorry, 2 days on IVIG. And then by Wednesday, they had decided, enough tests had come back that they were going to go with IV steroids. And so they did that for 5 days and then tapered for 10 days, with orals. And so, even though, you know, checking back at my text messages with my wife and our just conversations, AFM was hinted back, I think, on the third day we were there. Nobody ever officially diagnosed him with AFM, but I felt like they, after looking at the MRI and you know, I think by the grace of God and by the experience of the doctors and the radiologist had seen, I think, a couple of similar cases a few years before, and they had sent them to, you know, so I'm asking questions like, you know, what is it? You know, and I'm Googling AFM, and I found the group, like Rachel mentioned, on Facebook. And because all of the symptoms led me to, you know, this, you know, what everybody was saying online was one in a million or more in terms of probability, which I just thought was crazy in terms of the probabilities. You know, and then the look on say the first neurologist's face when she was testing his reflexes, and she had this dumbfounded look, this confused look, and I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "Well, he's flaccid. There's no reaction." And so, you know, I'm like sitting there between doctors as they come in, Googling, you know, flaccid and myelitis and all this, and that's how I stumbled upon, you know, AFM, and found the AFM group on Facebook. And so then I'm making suggestions before he's being transferred. Could this be AFM? And I remember the doctors, a lot of them saying, no, it's not AFM, you know? And so, anyway, so that's kind of like his initial treatments, but the best decision I think we made was, you know, attempting the interventions, but also getting to intensive in hospital therapy. And we decided to go, we had two options, and we decided to go with Kennedy Krieger Institute. So he was immediately transferred, and we were accepted into that, which was great because he couldn't even lift his head off the pillow at this point.
Right, right. Yeah. So we're going to talk a bit more about rehab and kind of your experience with that in a bit. So thank you again, Jeremy, for sharing all of that. And I know, Rachel, you said that when Breeden was first, you know, when the diagnoses were kind of happening, that they had all these other diagnoses that they were considering. Did they explain to you kind of how they ruled those out prior to confirming AFM? Or did they explain to you why it was AFM, or you know why it was different than their kind of initial diagnoses?
Yeah, I can't remember what made them rule it out specifically. But the, you know, what eventually had them land on AFM was the MRI, and it, you know, had the kind of hallmark gray matter damage that AFM has. It did take them a while to get there. Like, I think from, I'm trying to remember exactly when, but it was 7 to 9 days probably from when he started getting weak before we had an AFM diagnosis. And, you know, it's hard to not second guess everything and wonder if we'd done something differently, would we have had different outcomes? Because it was a while before he started getting any treatment that was helpful for AFM. You know, we're not sure, obviously, I said earlier, if what kind of effect plasmapheresis and IVIG has. But, you know, I always wonder if we'd gotten that a few days earlier, would he have had a better recovery with his diaphragm and been able to breathe more? And, you know, no one can tell us, obviously. So it's not really a healthy thing to dwell on. But, yeah, the MRI is what led them to AFM. And, you know, it was just crazy hearing words like that. It, just like what Jeremy was saying with being one in a million. It's so just such a different place to be when you're suddenly having to deal with medical stuff that you is not on your radar at all.
Right, definitely. And then, so going back to Jeremy and then Rachel, if you could add as well, I know you said that, you know, in the hospital, they started physical rehab, you know, very quickly. Can you talk a little bit more about your experience with the, you know, doing rehab kind of inpatient and then you know, if anything is still going on now in terms of rehab?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so looking back on it, it's actually kind of crazy. I remember a physical therapist coming into his room at the hospital in the ICU. You know, we hadn't even been there 24 hours. And I'm trying to remember if this was, it might have been before the MRI. But I remember them coming in and, you know, they wanted me to help him stand up, and he couldn't stand, and he was in a lot of pain, but that was their first attempt. So, I mean, you know, they did have an occupational therapist and physical therapist come by, I think at least once a day while we were in the hospital. And, you know, Child Life came by and tried to get him to move his hands and things like that, through fun activities. You know, one of the fun things that he enjoyed doing was they were just coming up with ideas, you know, because it's not like, you know, how do you encourage a 4-year-old to move their limbs when they're in pain? You know, and so, you know, I think one of his favorite activities was, you know, they took these bottles and these water bottles and filled them with, like, you know, water, you know, it was paint basically. And they were to get him to squeeze his hands. So he was, you know, he was painting on these big sheets. And there's a funny story. I'll tell it because, I mean, you know, I think all of us parents who are going through this, you know, look for humor, you know, sometimes in our darkest moments, you know, just to relieve the stress. But there was this one time where he was painting with red paint and he had sprayed it all over the floor. And I don't know why, but one of the nurses decided to prank the other nurse. And so, you know, she quickly called her in and they were all in scrubs and there was, you know, red paint everywhere. And so you can imagine, you know, the freak out, but they were just trying to, I think, lighten the mood and you know, in a very difficult situation with our kids. And in this case, Joey, you know, played along and liked that. But, you know, the transition, actually, no, I'll say this too. The day before we transferred to Kennedy Krieger Institute, one of the PTs there at the hospital, you know, took him up to a different floor, and we went up there to this rehab, in-house rehab, area with all new equipment. It has just been built, I think, a couple of years ago, maybe just in the past year, and was able to get him to sit up, you know, and helped him sit up, but also, you know, to play these different games and move his hands, and then was able to assist him in making, you know, in trying to take a couple of steps. And so, you know, we were wheeling him around in a wagon in the hospital with pillows because he couldn't move, couldn't really move. You know, from that, we transferred it to Kennedy Krieger Institute, where, you know, upwards of 7 hours a day of physical therapy, occupational therapy. My wife stayed with him almost every single night. I think we traded off just a couple times, but really she was the rock behind, you know, getting Joey to be motivated, and she stayed by his side. And so it's very difficult for her, being away from her baby and from her other children. But for Joey, it was the best, you know, we wanted to give him the best opportunity, and, you know, speech therapy as well. They had, you know, swimming, he was doing rock climbing. They, you know, they progressed. He was progressing each day. After a couple of days, he started to make progress. And so, you know, he transitioned from, you know, not being able to move to, you know, being in a high back wheelchair to being in a low back wheelchair to, you know, using a walker or crutches. And, you know, eventually he was able to, you know, start to walk short distances. And so it was all about momentum and you know, keeping that intensive therapy and movement to essentially reteach the body how to move and you know, keep the neural pathways or rebuild, you know, what had been damaged to continue that progress. So we transitioned from that to outpatient. We were in Loudoun County, Virginia, Northern Virginia. They had never treated an AFM patient before. And we were doing PT and OT a couple times a week in outpatient. He graduated from OT, quote unquote graduated, meaning to the home program. But when he left that program last month, he was he tested functionally in the normal range for his age, which was just incredible. And PT, you know, is wrapping up. So literally he is functionally back 100%. You know, he still has some residual weakness in one of his limbs, but I mean, I don't know if we want to get into deficits, but the point being that he's made incredible recoveries and tremendous recoveries from where he was last September, October.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. I really appreciate you sharing that, and it's wonderful to hear the progress that Joey has made. That's awesome. And I appreciate too the humor of the medical staff. I think that also serves a very good purpose in rehabilitation as well, in order to maintain a smile in difficult times and keep pushing through. So Rachel, how about you? Can you tell us a bit more about Braden's physical rehabilitation, how it started, you know, what they did inpatient, moving to outpatient, and kind of where he's at today in the process?
Sure. So Braden was intubated, and that kind of limited his therapy at the, you know, in the ICU until we made the decision to get him a trach. But, you know, from a very early on, right, kind of with what Jeremy said, the art therapist and the music therapist who would come in and, you know, just try to encourage him to move his hand a little bit to paint or, you know, pat a drum, was really the most important thing just in lifting his spirits in the beginning, because he, you know, he couldn't talk. He got sick on the 4th of July and really couldn't regularly speak again until probably October. So we had a little 5-year-old who couldn't communicate with us and tell us about how he was feeling and, you know, how scary, I'm getting emotional now, but you know, how scary it was to be intubated and, you know, be living in a hospital when he was a regular kid a few days before. So we're really grateful to the Child Life and all those therapists who kind of helped him feel a little bit of that normal kid play. But they did start doing PT and OT as early as they could. And once we got a trach, so instead of being intubated through his mouth, he has a trach in his neck still to help him breathe. Once we did that, he was able to participate more in therapy. And I just have heartbreaking pictures of them trying to get him to sit on the edge of the bed. And, you know, it was taking three therapists just to get him in a sitting position and to maintain that. And it was so painful for him, and he couldn't talk to us about it. He would just cry. So it was a rough start because the other thing, it was during the Summer Olympics. So we would watch, you know, we'd watch Olympics from his bed and watch the people running and try to encourage him by, you know, relating things to the Olympics. But it was a really slow process and still is a slow process, but he is continuing to make progress the whole way through, which gives us so much hope. But after about 8 weeks of being in a hospital in Houston, and that was about 2 hours from home. So we had other kids at home. We had people caring for our children. I still had a baby. I had a 9-month-old when he got sick that I, you know, didn't take a bottle. So we were struggling to figure out how to feed my baby when she couldn't be with me. So we spent 8 weeks kind of living this chaotic life before we found a rehab that he could go to. And somehow Houston, as big of a city and medical center that it has, didn't have a rehab facility that would take kids with trachs and vents. So he went to a rehab in Dallas, which was about 6 hours from where we lived at the time. And he was there for 5.5 months. So when he got there, he was on the vent 24/7. He couldn't talk, couldn't swallow anything. He could move his legs a little. He could move his left arm a little, but really was at basically zero, like could not do anything. And from there, he, you know, did an hour of PT, OT, and speech a day and did some child life activities and slowly just kept making progress. And it's hard to look back at all. We took so many videos. It's hard to watch those, but some of them are just like the first time he sat up for 30 seconds was like he, you know, had just won the biggest prize in the world. Like we were so thrilled to see him sit for 30 seconds. So it was a whole readjustment of celebrating different things and figuring out how to motivate him to do hard work. He played the iPad a lot. He had a lot of screen time, and anything we could give him to motivate him, we would give him. So when we left rehab, we were there 5.5 months, which is very long. Our family did not all, you know, sleep under the same roof that whole time. Our kids would come up on the weekends, and Saul and I, my husband and I, would swap places sometimes, but primarily I was spending all the time there just because he had to, you know, do his job and continue to make money and keep our insurance. But when Braden left, he could stand a little bit with some assistance. He would take a few steps with a lot of help. He was spending some time off the vent during the day, and had made a lot of progress in a lot of places. There's some areas where he hadn't made as much progress, and those continue to be his biggest deficits. But so that was, we were there 5.5 months and were discharged home. He, since then, that was a little over 2 years ago when he came home, he has had full-time nursing care. So we have a nurse with him all day and all night, which has been a huge change just for our family dynamic. Now we have an extra person with us wherever we go. And we've been fortunate to have great nurses, but it's still, you know, just a different type of living. Now we have a bonus person with us all the time. He does a lot of therapy at home. We have an FES bike. So that's something that helps use electrical stimulation to get a muscle contraction in his arms and legs while he's doing a bike. So we try to do that daily. He walks on the treadmill most days, and we just have a variety of other activities we do in our house. My dad built him some little therapy stairs so he can practice walking up and down the stairs. We have a vibrating plate for him to stand on to get some more, hopefully build bone density that way. He does speech activities at home. So it's been a long, long, continuous, slow recovery. Right now his trach is capped all day and all night. So we're hoping that he can potentially get his trach out later this summer. He still has no ability to swallow. So like when you go to the dentist and they suction your mouth, we do that frequently throughout the day because he can't swallow his own saliva. No food. He gets all of his nutrition through a tube to his stomach. He can walk short distances. Like some days he walks home from school, and that seems like such a miracle to that my kid can walk home from school. He has a walker and he is not the sturdiest and he needs lots of breaks, but he can do it. And his left arm is continuing to make progress. His right arm is primarily still flaccid. His neck is very weak, so he wears a neck brace. But he's continuing to do more and more therapy. We spent 6 weeks at Kennedy Krieger last year, and that was great just for education purposes, learning about what we can be doing at home and making sure he has all the right equipment. And doing, I mean, like Jeremy was talking about, it's just a lot of therapy. He was doing about 6 hours of therapy a day and getting to use all of their awesome equipment to give him a big boost. We're planning on going back to the rehab in Dallas next month for a few weeks just to get another big boost and kind of iron some things out. But it's, you know, our whole world is recentered now around Brayden and making sure he can have the best recovery possible. Trying to figure out how to make everything we do something therapeutic for him and how to involve him in that and make sure that he's still getting to have as much of a childhood that he can, but also maximizing the recovery that he can. And it's a fine line that we're always trying to figure out. But it, I mean, yes, lots and lots of therapy, but it's a long, slow recovery that we still see progress from him, even now, almost 3 years out.
Yeah, thank you, Rachel. You know I was getting choked up when you were talking as well. And I, you know, it's always amazing to me seeing how the therapists work with these little kids on stuff and get them motivated. It's always, always enjoy seeing that. And
it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's they come up with these really creative ways to get them to move. And yeah, and you know, continuing the therapy at home. I mean, I think that's a big part for a lot of people where, you know, you can't do it all in a therapy place. So you got to figure out how to keep going and kind of celebrate those victories of like walking home from school, as much as possible. So thank you for sharing. You know, it's tough to kind of look back, sometimes. Jeremy, you know, when did you begin to see that Joey was improving? Was it, early on, were you seeing kind of improvement at the beginning and then it ramped up, or you know, how did that kind of trajectory go?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I'll just say Rachel's story is incredible. I mean, a lot of these mothers and fathers out there, you know, have been on longer journeys than we have. I know we all start at the same point, or at least, you know, our children are going through, you know, something like this, but you know, it's amazing to see progress and hear about progress from you know, kids, or, you know, and there's about 10% of, I want to mention that 10% of folks with AFM are adults as well. But seeing progress, you know, 3-4 years out, I mean, and just incremental little things, twitching of fingers and things like that to remarkable, incredible, you know, dramatic recoveries or improvements, through things like, nerve transfers and some of the other things that are going on right now in the community. You know, for my son, there were very small improvements, I'd say, each day. There were a few days where we just really kind of didn't see much progress. But in reality, looking back, you know, it started with his fingers and him being able to go from, you know, and encouraging him and saying, look, you can pick up that, you know, half of the sandwich and, you know, with two hands and try to, you know, reach your face, or, you know, why don't you try picking up the, you know, the cup with a straw. And that was over, you know, a 14-day period or so, or 10-day period, but seeing, you know, little changes, you know, baby steps in terms of improvement. And it was hard to determine whether that was just part of his recovery, or if there was anything that we were doing or being, you know, that he was being treated for that helped with that. We definitely saw dramatic improvements when we got to Kennedy Krieger. And I didn't believe my wife, but I almost didn't believe my wife when she texted me. You know, I had just dropped my kids off with my in-laws in North Carolina where they had just moved to retire. And I was driving back to a conference in Philadelphia and was gonna pass through Baltimore on my way. And she said that Joey had sat up and had actually like taken a step, and I didn't. So, I mean, I ended up stopping in Baltimore to see it because to me, it was incredible that he had been able to do that just in a couple of days, going from, you know, not being able to lift his head off of the pillow to, you know, making that progress. And so that's when we really started to see a lot of progress, even, I guess, you know, with the last couple of days in the hospital. But from there, it was just every single day. You know, I think psychologically, I remember I think it was the head of PT who was, you know, really encouraging us in the hospital to go to inpatient rehab. I remember him saying, this is a journey. It's a marathon. It could take weeks to months to years. Right. And there's no real, it's a big unknown. Right. I remember asking him, you know, when do you think he'll recover, or, you know, when will he make progress enough to come home? I mean, at one point he just kind of ballparked it like, oh, you know, probably 4 months, you know? And so it was, you know, to get to what, you know, what percentage, there were just a lot of unknowns. But we saw tremendous, you know, gains. When he left inpatient rehab, he had an AFO on his right leg, which, you know, it doesn't go all the way to the knee. It's more focused on the ankle. It doesn't go above the knee. And this was to help his right leg, which was weaker than his left. So he wouldn't hyperextend his knee, and it was helping with his walking. He couldn't lift his arms above 90 degrees, and he couldn't hold anything really. So he had deficits, but he could still walk. I mean, he would fall, or his, you know, 2-year-old sister would push him down because, you know, just the excitement of playing with his siblings. And yeah, he would just fall. He'd drop, like he couldn't, you know, really hold his balance. And so we continued to see progress during outpatient as well. I think it's a combination of, you know, making those treatments fun, but also, you know, when the average age for onset here is like 4 or 5, that's, you know, when our kids are the most active in their life, right? I mean, and to go from that to not being able to move, you know, is like the complete opposite of what should be happening for a normal, healthy kid. And so I think for our experience, I mean, seeing our child, seeing Joey playing with his siblings was therapy, you know? And I remember him when he was in the hospital, just wanting to hold his baby brother, who was just a few months old. And you know, we have pictures of him, you know, when my son couldn't really move, but his younger brother was there, and he just the smile on his face was incredible. And you know, it was those things that motivated him. There was, you know, he got a lot of screen time, like Rachel's son and others. And he would, you know, his favorite thing to do was, you know, he liked to dance a lot. And so dancing is movement. And so, you know, at one point, he would do these dances from this game called Fortnite. There was a mobile app that had all of the dances. And so he would just spend time looking at all the dances. And then from his hospital bed, just moving his arms, you know, but nothing, or his hands, sorry, you know, and before he could do the full dance, but now he could just move his hands. You know, just thinking back to those experiences. But all of that was helpful in his progress.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's always amazing to hear the progression and to be able to look back. And sometimes I know when we're in the moment, it's hard to realize some of those improvements as they're happening, and then being able to look back and to see how far they've come. It's really incredible. Rachel, I know you had mentioned too that Braden is able to walk home from school, and that is absolutely awesome. A question for you, Rachel, from from your perspective as a parent, do you feel that Braden is still continuing to progress in his recovery? And how do you discuss with him what has happened? I believe he's old enough to obviously understand that things are not the same for him as they may be for his siblings or his peers. And how do you talk with him about his diagnosis and the differences? And probably more importantly, how do you maintain hope for recovery for Braden and for your family?
Those are great questions. So yeah, he does continue to make progress. It's slow, but you know, we can tell, we write down how far he walks on the, he does 45 minutes on the treadmill a few times a week. So we'll always write down how far he walked, and you know, he's continuing to walk faster and further, and it's slow progress. But when we look back to how far he could walk a year ago, he's walking probably 50% further right now in 45 minutes, which is great. Or I'm a math person, so I like to look at the data from the FES bike that it gives us. So I love seeing his little graph of the results from his FES bike getting higher every time. We have like tiny victories. Like he used to need his mouth suctioned, the spit suctioned out every minute, and now it's like once or twice an hour. So that doesn't seem like a great recovery, but just from a quality of life standpoint, that's huge. To not have rely on someone every minute or two to suction spit out of your mouth is just a huge quality of life change for him. So he does make progress all the time, kind of like what Jeremy was talking about. Falling, that's a huge concern for us, because he has broken a lot of bones doing really minor things because he's lost a lot of bone density. So he hasn't had a broken bone in a year, which is another huge victory. So we continue to see kind of strange victories like that, like celebrating your kid not breaking a bone in a year is kind of a horrible thing to celebrate, but it's still a victory for us. And then talking about how we talk to him about it, one thing that we've done, he had a nerve transfer, almost 2 years ago, where they take a nerve that is functioning and kind of rewire it to innervate a muscle that is not getting any innervation currently because that nerve was affected. So, you know, I wrote him a little children's book about that, about a robot who got water spilled on him. And so some of his wires stopped working and he had to go see the inventor, and the inventor had to move some wires so that his parts could work again. And that was, to me, seemed like a appropriate way to talk to, at that point he was six, a six-year-old about what was going on with him. Some of his wires didn't work anymore. It wasn't his fault. They just stopped working. And sometimes the doctor can move a nerve and help that area. Sometimes we just work really hard and it gets stronger on its own. And sometimes it doesn't get stronger and we don't know why, but it may get stronger later. So we want to keep exercising to keep that part of your body healthy. These are the conversations I have. So now I sound like I'm talking to a child, but you know, we're just trying to tell him that we don't know what's going to happen in the future. We don't know what kind of awesome things science and medicine is going to come up with that might help those parts of your body work again. So we're going to do everything that we can right now to make sure that he's healthy and doing as much as he can so that his body would be, you know, able to do any future treatment that science may come up with. And, you know, Braden has a great personality and is always positive. I hate thinking about what if this had happened to my other kids, but honestly, I don't think any of my other kids could have handled it as well as Braden has. I've never heard him complain. Every time he talks about AFM, he says, well, it's kind of bad, but it's also good because I get the iPad more. So he's really embraced his, increase in screen time and in getting to watch stuff, and never feels left out, is never sad about missing things, which is amazing for my heart to not, I don't know how I would handle it if I saw him being sad about what he was missing out on. He's rarely sad about it. He loves to draw and read, so he's always excited to get to do those things. But we do try to keep him, you know, doing as much with us as possible and trying to make sure that we're picking activities as a family that he can do as well, which ends up being Disney World for us. Disney World has been a great place that's completely accessible and welcoming, and he can do everything that everybody else can do. So, you know, we try to gear our activities towards things that he can be involved in. But he's just amazing, and we're so proud of his attitude towards everything and how he takes it in stride. Like, you know, the breathing is still a problem, and we're working on wearing a different back brace for his scoliosis and trying to get him to sleep with a cap on. And it's hard to watch your child cry and say that he can't breathe, or it hurts when you're trying to do things that you know will help him long term. And that's, you know, that's a struggle to try to paint that in a positive light and help him understand why he has to sleep with a hard plastic brace on his back, or why we're not letting him breathe through his trach and he has to sleep with a mask on his face to give him some pressure support to breathe. You know, it's always a challenge trying to get them to do hard things and not hate you for it. You know, but you know, we're trying to always keep him healthy. So that's it in a nutshell.
Right. Yeah. And it's always amazing to hear how resilient these kids are with such, you know, challenging, you know, sudden life changes, and, you know, how they still see the good and stuff. It's, Jeremy, you know, how, in terms of your, you know, experience with Joey, how do you discuss kind of what's happened with him, and how do you also continue to maintain hope for the future?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think at the age of four, you know, they obviously know something's wrong, and you know, I remember, I think one of the questions he asked my wife and I was, you know, he equated what he had to being a quote unquote floppy human. And there's these different games where you're floppy, like Human Fall Flat, I think, is one of the games he used to play on the Xbox, where you're kind of, it's a physics game and you're just moving around, but all floppy. And so it's like, you know, he's taking that personal experience and, you know, saying, why, you know, am I always going to be a floppy human? And that was like a really difficult question to answer. Although my wife, you know, and we basically said, you know, of course you're not going to always be a floppy human. But, you know, he would ask questions about, you know, how long until I'm not a floppy human. But then, you know, once he really focused, I think, on you know, the progress he was making and wanted to be with his siblings again. So I'd say, I mean, there were obviously perks when he was there in the hospital and at Kennedy Krieger. He could get more screen time. He could, you know, order up meals that he, you know, whatever he wanted, so to speak, get more attention than, you know, having to compete with his siblings for more time, at least one-on-one. But yeah, I mean, he continues to make progress. We don't talk about AFM as much in our house now. You know, as he continues to make progress, I think time will tell, you know, whether he has, you know, issues down the road. We're hopeful that he's already made a functional recovery. So, you know, we're very hopeful that, you know, he continues to improve and that, you know, any deficits continue to reduce. And so, yeah, I mean, like there's very subtle changes there's slight changes, and it's hard to think back at the deficits. It's better to focus on what he has and the progress he's made and trying to restore normalcy to, you know, a very busy household, where he's just you know, rambunctious kid and running around, you know, right now at the beach, and he just enjoys his time playing in the sand and running away from the waves, and he's actually going in the water and always, you know, wrestling or playing with his siblings, and so in a lot of ways we just, you know, we're focused on all the progress he's made and continue to see hope from, you know, and I see a lot of promise with, you know, what could happen in terms of developments, in the medical community, you know, and that's one of the big reasons why I've been an advocate, you know, not just for my own son, but for everyone and for, you know, unfortunately the children that, that will be affected or the people that will be affected when this comes back and the recurrence. So, you know, raising awareness with all the right stakeholders and with other parents to look for early, signs and symptoms. I think it'll also be interesting, you know, and there are a lot of children that are getting older and they're able to write and they're able to speak for themselves. And I think it'll be interesting for our children, for their voices to be heard, you know, and to get their perspectives as they get older, and be able to share from their experience what they've gone through and how they can help others. Hold out hope that there's always hope for improvement and that their life has tremendous meaning.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. I sincerely appreciate you and Rachel both being advocates of hope for not just your own children, but for all of the children and families that that may be impacted by a rare neuroimmune disorder. It's incredible. We're actually coming towards the end of our podcast now, and to wrap up our conversation today, I'd like to ask both of you, if you, as you look back, you know, through that critical time of learning of the diagnosis and finding so little information or even misinformation about causation or not knowing, you know, what treatments are available, what's going to work, what kind of prognosis your children were going to be given, or even, you know, the counts of AFM that existed. Is there anything you'd like to share that you wish you could have asked or wish you could have known at that time? Jeremy, do you want to go ahead?
Go ahead, Jeremy.
I cut out for a second. I wasn't sure if you were asking me or Rachel.
It's okay if you want to go ahead and start. That's fine. Sure.
Yeah, I'll just real quick. For me, thinking back, I mean, if I had been aware of, first off, I mean, and this is probably universal for all of us parents, but for us in particular, I mean, no one ever grows up thinking that, you know, a perfectly healthy child can get a cold and in a matter of days and sometimes hours or within 24 hours become paralyzed with a life-threatening condition from what, you know, appears to be just a common cold that doesn't really affect anybody. And so just being aware that that's even possible and looking for early signs and symptoms that AFM exists and that it's possible to for someone to come down with this and to be persistent because, you know, in the early days when we got sent home from the hospital the first time, we should have pressed and, you know, would it have made a difference? I don't know. But, you know, I think in our case, and we were fortunate to obviously be admitted the second time to a different hospital, but and then just, you know, the long-term prognosis. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think raising awareness with physicians and with just in terms of what to do or how to diagnose AFM. The biggest one for me, just being aware that this is a condition that can happen and that there is a group out there too. And that's the other thing, you know, that we found quickly, but that there are groups out there that care and that have a lot of information. There are people out there with a ton of knowledge, just getting that information in the right hands quickly is key, you know? So that's my thought.
Thank you, Jeremy. And what about you, Rachel?
Yeah, I think that raising awareness with the general public as well as physicians that anytime a kid or an adult has limb weakness following a cold, it needs to be taken seriously. We have too many families who get sent home when their kid shows up with some paralysis, and we don't know exactly what treatments are helpful, but we have to believe that, you know, the more data and the more treatments we try, we're going to figure out what helps kids, limits the damage to their spinal cord and helps them have better recoveries. So we're grateful for the group that the TMA is doing with the working group that Dr. Pardo is heading up, and we're optimistic about more research and more papers coming out that hopefully gives physicians more, information about what could lead to better outcomes. It's just scary when there's so much unknown. So we're excited to see more information hopefully coming out on the horizon that will help these kids.
Thank you. Thank you both so much for taking the time today. You know, we really appreciate it. And I know it can be tough to talk about this, but, it's so important to get your stories out there. And, thank you so much for sharing. We really appreciate it and for everything you do for these kids and families.
Thank you so much.
Agreed.
Thank you very much.
Agreed. Thank you very much. We appreciate your time and your willingness to share your stories. And down the road, we hope to hear from your children as they begin to find their voice and share their own stories too. So thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.